Gordon. This is The Connection. One of the strongest believers in the United Nations has a piece of advice for others who aren't so sure. Read the preamble, she says. The opening lines of the UN Charter, first composed back when the ashes of the Second World War were still warm. We, the peoples of the United Nations, it says, determined to save succeeding generations from the scourge of war. Jane Hall Lute now has her opportunity to do something for those succeeding generations. After an impressive career in the U.S. Army and then in conflict prevention, she's moving to the UN Peacekeeping Department as Assistant Secretary General. Jane Hall Lute agrees that the UN's looking a little battered these days, but she says it's still the best international organization for managing global unrest. Even to the point, if necessary, of using UN peacekeepers in the Middle East. Connection listeners, how do you measure the importance today of UN peacekeepers, the men and the women in blue helmets? Are they the best ones to help stop war? Would you, for example, send the blue helmets into Israel or the West Bank? Would they? Could they make a difference there? Our number is 1-800-423-8255. 1-800-423-TALK. And my guest this hour is Jane Hall Lute. She takes up her new duties as Assistant Secretary General for Peacekeeping in about 6 weeks. Welcome back to The Connection.
Thanks very much.
Congratulations on your new job.
Thank you.
Now, not only do you bring some strong U.S. military credentials to this job, but you bring that American passport. I'm wondering if in your mind this is going to be something that'll be useful as something of a bridge between people who've become increasingly skeptical about peacekeeping in the U.S. and, well, you know that debate.
Well, I hope so, but in many ways I feel like as an American I'm going back to my roots. In a very core way, the United States was at the heart of the consensus that gave rise to the United Nations, and so for me this is a very natural progression in my own career.
But in the last few months, a lot of people in this country have drifted away from that core belief, drawn in part by people within the administration who are saying, well, maybe that's not the institution it used to be.
Well, the institution is only as good as its member states will allow it to be. I think very clearly that the consensus of 45 that gave rise to the UN has broken down. It's been beaten down, watered down, shouted down in some cases. And there are those who believe that international institutions of any kind don't serve U.S. interests very well. I don't agree with that view.
But do you agree that the consensus is broken down? Are you saying that's one point of view, or are you thinking that's a problem?
No, I do in fact think that the consensus that gave rise 55-odd years ago among the 51 member states who came together in San Francisco and agreed in a very particular geostrategic setting of the end of World War II, which was really not only the defeat of Nazism, but the repudiation of an old order. And they said, you know what, we've got to be able to do better. Around what can we agree? Around sovereign equality? Around not using force to manage our differences, and what else can we agree on? It was that consensus that I think over years, because of the Cold War, decolonialization, new members, new missions, the post-Cold War period, I think that consensus has broken down and it's time to reestablish a core consensus for international relations.
And what's the basis for that new consensus?
Well, I think certainly a couple of things. One is the new reality that states face. Governance has probably outgrown governments. That is to say, governments have previously had the corner on the market on the control of lethality, the control of rulemaking, and the control of capital. And now what we know is that that control has really migrated out of government hands and largely into the hands of private individuals, the private sector, into the marketplace, into criminal organizations, into solitary individuals in some cases. And governments need to come to grips with this new reality and with how they will deal with each other in the face of that reality.
You're talking about good power and bad power. You're talking about the power of the corporation on one hand, which may not be a threat to global security, but also the power of the terrorist on the other hand. Am I right? That's
exactly right. Vast amounts of capital lie beyond the control of governments. We need to begin to think about what are the implications of that. Vast amounts of lethality lie beyond the control of many governments. We need to think about the implications of that as well.
I wonder if we can do that in context of the latest group of people to go off under a UN banner in Congo, because to me that's an example, perhaps, you can correct me on this, of a shifting set of priorities within the department that you're about to join. We know that there were the Uruguayan peacekeepers stuck in their compound just, you know, with the wherewithal to protect the people. And a couple of weeks back, 1,400 French soldiers, tough, hard, battle-ready soldiers, were volunteered by their government, sanctioned by the UN, to go in. And they're not really there, are they, Jane, as classic peacekeepers, you know, determined not to use their weapons?
Well, the role of classic peacekeepers, you know, under so-called Chapter 6 operations, really was originally conceived as an interpositional force between warring parties who agree that they need that separation in order to step back from violence. The situation in the Congo, the tragic, tragic situation, millions of people have been killed and displaced. This chronic violence that has been going on for years, exacerbated by the engagement of neighboring states in some cases, and presents a situation where the peacekeeping challenge is one to be more assertive. And the current mandate is a Chapter 7, that is to say they have the authority to use force in the enforcement of their missions, at quite a different circumstance.
Does that mean that the people who are given the task of keeping the peace under the UN Blue Beret in the years ahead will have perhaps more power, more the ability to use more strength on the ground than we have become accustomed to?
Well, certainly that's been the case in the post-Cold War period. Up until that time, there really had been very few instances of these so-called enforcement actions. They had largely been classical peacekeeping operations, consent of the parties, the force has been inserted, neutral and impartial with respect to the issues in the parties, and able to use force in self-defense, but not in an aggressive way to assert the accomplishment of a mission. That has changed. That changed in the 1990s. And I think we're learning the extensiveness of these operations and what really is possible. Will they become more powerful? That depends on what the member states empower these operations to do.
And that's going to be based in part on how well they're seen to be doing, because people now, when they talk about UN peacekeeping, will list on one hand those exercises that are thought to have been a great success and others that are thought to have been less successful.
Right. As with anything, you know, people claim that the UN's peacekeeping record is mixed. My response is, compared to what? These are very difficult, complex problems. If we didn't have the capacity to insert peacekeepers, if the world states did not recognize their responsibilities to help deal with some of these very difficult transnational problems, we would probably have to invent it. But in fact, we have over 50 years of experience in and a learning dimension to how to manage these very difficult problems.
Let's talk, if we can, about Kofi Annan's interview with Haaretz newspaper a couple of days back, in which he said, and I'm trying to quote him accurately here, "I would like to see an armed peacekeeping force act as a buffer between the Israelis and the Palestinians." It's got to be something that's on your mind as you prepare to move to that department in the summertime. Do you think, based on what we know about the roadmap and what we've seen over the past 3 years and the past 53 years, that the UN peacekeepers, in the way that we've been talking about them this morning, have a role there?
Well, let me first say, as you did at the outset, I'm not yet in this position, and so would not presume to speak on behalf of the institution in any way. But from the perspective of a very interested and committed outsider at the moment, is there a role for outsiders to play in this dispute between the Israelis and the Palestinians? I think the answer is clearly yes. The United States, for example, has been trying to play such a role for many years. The UN itself has a presence, a long-standing presence in the region to deal with other aspects of the violence that has occurred between parties there. And so I think there's no question that if both the parties and those who are outside actors with the greatest equities believe that a force is useful, then I think one should be put in.
No, you said just at the tail end, if both parties agree. It seems pretty clear to me, and would to you for your experience here, that the Israelis are highly unlikely to ever want to say yes to a UN peacekeeping force.
Well, again, they can certainly speak for themselves. I think what they also recognize is that this is a problem that is not self-healing, that is not self-correcting, and that outsiders can help provide the political and physical space necessary for alternative means of brokering the disputes that have almost become existential in some people's minds, and helping create the space necessary for this dispute to choose a different course for its resolution other than the history of violence that has marked it.
But Jane, can you imagine a circumstance under which an Israeli prime minister would say, no, we don't want the UN peacekeepers, and the UN Security Council would say, and we don't want to see what's been going on in that region continue, so give us a chance, give us a break, let us try that?
Well, like I lived through the events of 1989. I can imagine almost anything. But as we all did, but I think there are a couple of things to keep in mind here. Israel's relationship to the United Nations has been a complex one over the years. There have been good things and bad things about it from a number of perspectives. I think, however, that if it becomes clear that the only thing standing between a peaceful and secure state of Israel and in the neighborhood where it exists is a force of some kind, then those circumstances may be such that everyone can agree. Will the outside community, will the Security Council impose such a force? I don't think we've reached that question yet.
Mm-hmm. And we should be very clear, we're just speculating about what might be ahead, but it does give us some kind of guidance as to where the UN could be or would be. What could the UN bring to that region that the U.S. has been unable to bring? Because you're saying at the very beginning that the U.S. has been trying to provide this broker position now for the past 50 years, and perhaps it's time for the U.N. to take its turn at that. What could the U.N. do that the U.S. can't?
I don't really think of it that way. I think of how the UN could add value to the effort that has been undertaken by the United States and by others in the region. The UN has a tradition in its both its peacekeeping background and its other activities of protecting human rights, monitoring conflicts, monitoring ceasefires, observing elections, troop withdrawal, standoff with forces. It's a presence that has. When blue helmets come into the region, they're not only representing the mission at hand, but the tradition of mission, the tradition of legitimacy, the tradition of impartiality and commitment by the international community to help warring parties broker their differences in relative peace. And I think the UN can bring all of that to bear.
All right, Connection listeners, my guest this hour is Jane Hall-Lute. She has a new job. She starts on the 1st of August as the Assistant Secretary General for Mission Support in the Department of Peacekeeping at the United Nations. And we're talking about the future of UN peacekeepers. We're interested in hearing your point of view. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. Would you, for example, consider sending blue helmets into Israel or the West Bank? How do you measure the importance today of UN peacekeepers? I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-TALK. And this hour, talk about the future of UN peacekeeping. My guest is Jane Hall-Lute. She has a new job at the United Nations, Assistant Secretary General in the Department of Peacekeeping. And we're joined also on the line by Ambassador Robert Oakley. He's a career diplomat with the U.S. State Department, was U.S. Special Representative to Somalia from 92 to 94. And he's now working at the National Defense University in Washington doing research on Iraq, Afghanistan, and peacekeeping. Ambassador, welcome.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
You've been listening in and also have some of your own ideas about the future of UN peacekeeping. It seems in many ways like we're at something of a pivot point, that this may be the beginning of a new age for UN peacekeeping or not. What do you think?
Well, first, I want to congratulate everybody concerned, especially Jane, for having been given this assignment, for having taken it, and the United Nations for having selected her. I've known Jane for a long time. I think she'll do a super job, and I'm glad she's going to be there.
Thanks, Bob.
So far as UN peacekeeping is concerned, I think we have to distinguish between different varieties of peacekeeping. And, you know, Ambassador Brahimi, who's currently the UN Special Representative to Afghanistan, did a very thorough sort of assessment of UN peacekeeping as the head of a panel in the year 2000 and made a number of recommendations about peacekeeping. Number one, that in the future, both the members of the Security Council as a whole, and the Secretary General be much more careful in what they're doing before they undertake a mission. The mandate needs to be very clear. The objectives have to be realistic and achievable, and the resources to support the operation have to be there. This is in reaction to some notable failures in Rwanda and Bosnia in particular, where United Nations members overreached in giving the United Nations an assignment which it was unable to carry out because they weren't given the resources to match the mission.
Well, are we where, Ambassador I've lost his name, Lakhimi said we ought to be in terms of making sure that UN peacekeeping efforts now are given a clearer mandate?
I think they've been much more careful. They also have followed up on another point that had been in practice before the Brahimi panel met and which has been continued. That is a sort of a partnership arrangement when the situation is very dicey, when the threat is very high, recognizing the limitations of a UN force and allowing some sort of multinational force to do the job, and then followed by the United Nations. A very good example of that has been East Timor, where the Australians led a multinational force with the authorization of the UN Security Council, which put down the bulk of the unrest and then was followed by a UN force, which had the power to do its job and in some cases had to use deadly force and did it well. So you have situations of that kind. In Afghanistan, the United States, and leading a coalition, is primarily responsible for the security issues. Together with an international security assistance force, the UN is much more responsible for the political side. So that's a different type of a partnership. But it's still, in general, a big peacekeeping operation, which involves, as Jane said, all sorts of different things. And the UN has all sorts of different roles it can play. And so I think this idea of a partnership is one that needs to be considered.
Now, Bob, you also heard that part of our conversation when we were musing about the possibility of UN peacekeepers in the Middle East as an alternative to the situation that exists right now. What are your thoughts about that?
Well, for example, in 1974, the United Nations set up two peacekeeping forces, one in the Sinai and one in the Golan, really pursuant to a U.S. negotiated end to the 1973 war. So it was the U.S. and the United Nations and the parties, both Egypt with respect to the Sinai and Syria with respect to the Golan, who agreed upon UN observer forces, and there have been no incidents in the Sinai or the Golan for, almost 30 years now.
Okay, we're talking about something a little more interventionist here, though.
Well, but what you have to look at, on the other hand, is the UN force in southern Lebanon, which is unable to do anything, and to deal with the Hezbollah problems with Israel, which went on for a long, long time, and Israeli incursions into Lebanon. So you have to be very careful in looking at the particular situation involved. And right now, and the problem between the Palestinians and the Israelis, how would a UN force be able to distinguish, for example, a terrorist dressed as a conservative Orthodox Jew getting on a bus and somebody else and blowing up a bomb? Where would you get the intelligence that would enable you to deal with a situation of that kind, even if you were going to be interventionist? So maybe if the roadmap progresses and you get to phase two of the roadmap, there'll be some sort of geographic areas where the UN observers or UN force of some kind could be helpful, although I'm very, very skeptical that the Israelis would ever allow a UN force.
Well, Jane Holut, it's not a classic situation. There isn't a border that, you know, where the UN would be. What would you do in the situation of the bus that Ambassador Oakley's described?
Well, Ambassador Oakley is one of the wisest voices in our field, and he's quite right. You know, the level of intelligence and the sophistication of support operations around any troop presence would have to be quite significant, and that time may be somewhat further off at the moment. I think we really have to rethink how outsiders can construct an engagement of any type, partially with force, partially with other aspects of help and assistance. One of the things we learned in over the course of the 1990s is that a peacekeeping force is itself only an element of an overall solution to a problem. What's the larger political context? What are the conditions of well-being? What are the conditions of justice within which the conditions of security that the force is addressing make sense? And I think the same would apply here. We may need a new model.
Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. Let's take our first call from Woburn, Massachusetts. Eric's on the line. Hi, Eric.
Hi.
Thanks for calling.
Thank you. I couldn't agree more with Jane that one of her comments was compared to what and that we would probably have to invent it. I think that basically that one of the problems that we face now in the world is that the U.S. government has not supported the U.N. overall. And I have in front of me an email that was shared by a colleague of mine where they trace the forming of the UN to the Council of Foreign Relations, and they say that the Council of Foreign Relations has one objective in common. They want to bring about the surrender of the sovereignty and the national independence of the U.S. So that was from Harper's Magazine in July 1958, and then there are some other articles. But there are political groups in the United States that really believe that the UN is dangerous and it's anti-US and it's, you know, sort of almost communist.
We heard a lot of that so I'm paraded around in the last few months, Eric. You're quite right.
All right. So my response is, how do we, you know, I think this thinking has a sway with the U.S. government. I think there are people in the U.S. government, in the State Department, who really think that the UN is not a good thing for U.S. interests. And so how do we deal with that? Because I think ultimately we would have to invent something. I think there's a very good point that a lot of power and capital is outside the hands of governments. And what do we do? How do we build the U.N. back into, you know, mainstream political thinking?
Right. Or do we? I'd like to hear both my guests on that. So I think I'm going to start with Ambassador Oakley on Eric's point. Ambassador?
Well, I think the UN has been falsely accused because let's understand the point that Jane made in the beginning. Let's reaffirm it. The UN is what its members make it, and particularly the members of the UN Security Council led by the United States. And where the United States has taken a constructive role, we found very, very positive results from the point of view of not only U.S. interests but global interests, but our interests have hardly been sacrificed. As I say, the UN has served us very, very well on occasions where we've wanted to work with it, whether it's in Bosnia or Kosovo. UN assistance has come as a partnership arrangement with U.S.-led intervention.
Okay, but Jane Hall-Lewt, the UN's also been using a lot of its energy recently fighting that kind of rearguard battle against its critics.
That's right, and its friends have been trying to help fight that battle as well. The critics are flat wrong, in my view, and they've been wrong for a long time, back in the 1950s. This is not a new argument. I think they see in the current circumstances, perhaps in the run-up to Iraq, perhaps in this genuine breakdown in consensus that I talked about earlier, I think they see an opportunity to make some headway on this argument that the U.S. really has no use, not only for the U.N., but for any international institution, and that we're far better off going it alone and creating coalitions of supporters as we go. That's a view. That's an approach. I happen to think it's a very costly, labor-intensive approach, and it causes you to treat each problem as new, as if for the first time, each time you confront it. The UN clearly has its faults. No institution is perfect. But it is in many ways at the heart of the values and norms that this country holds very dear. That we can get along in relative peace.
Well, do you think, Jane, that the new consensus that you talk about would be one under which a country with a record like Libya's wouldn't end up as chairing the International Human Rights Committee? I mean, I just used it as an example, but it's often brought up on this program as a reason why the UN is losing respect.
It's a symptom, in my view. It's really a symptom of that the machinery needs overhaul, no question. I mean, and there's a relatively easy fix. If a country is under sanctions, then it's, you know, disqualified from holding any leadership position in any capacity. I mean, that would be a version of a fix that people have proposed. Sure, there's no question that things like that really don't make a lot of sense for an institution that aspires to the goals that the UN does. But really, this is a moment for states to come together. It's now well over 10 years after the end of the Cold War, a dynamic shift in the geopolitical circumstances of the world, one in which there's more uncertainty than certainty. And the great states of the world, of which the United States is arguably the greatest, needs to come together and say, around what can we agree? What will we hold important? How will we behave? How will we treat our citizens? What principles do we want to put in place to guide our relations? That time has come.
And just to ground that, how crucial is the role, the identity, the power, and the respect of peacekeeping in that new identity for the UN?
Well, in my view, peacekeeping has been one of the things for which the UN is best known. It's a function for which there has been great need throughout the history of the organization's existence. And so I think it will take its place again. The UN is a member state organization. The member states have determined for over 50 years that from time to time there is a need to become engaged in fights among their number and increasingly within states. The Security Council has taken these decisions. But as Ambassador Oakley said quite rightly, they've not always matched the resourcing with their rhetoric. And that's a correction that must be made.
So Bob Oakley, to what extent does this whole system need an overhaul so the peacekeepers can do the job that they're asked to do and do it well?
Well, again, I'll repeat, you need to look at peacekeepers in a very big sense. It's not simply blue berets. And you talked about the Congo in the very beginning. The French troops are in there. Are in there as part of a European Union operation, which is going to be followed, hopefully, by a UN operation after the degree of violence has gone down. The group that's in there now, they're tough soldiers. They have more freedom of action than they would have, probably, and more decisive command and control if there were a UN force. So you have various combinations. As Jane pointed out, a UN peacekeeping operation these days can include preparation of a constitution, can include humanitarian relief, reconstruction, all sorts of different things, as well as what's looked upon either as an observer role or a combat role. So you have to take all these things together, and I suspect that you're going to find that before long the United Nations is beginning to play a role even in Iraq, where there are certain ideological groups thought that the UN should never go because it can be useful to the United States and to everyone else who's trying to rebuild that shattered country.
Connection listeners, our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. We're talking about a redesign of sorts of the United Nations, one that would give the peacekeepers the sort of freedom and respect that they don't necessarily have in all quarters of the world right now. And we're doing that with Ambassador Robert Oakley and Jane Hall-Lute, who has a new job at the UN as Assistant Secretary General for Mission Support in the Department of Peacekeeping. 1-800-423-TALK to join us. Let's go next to Arlington, Massachusetts. Raoul's on the line. Hi, Raoul.
Hi there. Good morning.
Thanks for calling.
I want to support what Jane and Ambassador Oakley have both mentioned in terms of the principles and raise the issue of Afghanistan, where I was just for 2 months. Neither the U.S. policy nor forces nor the International Security Assistance Force have been doing the job in the last year and a half since the Taliban were mostly evicted from the country. That is to say, there is no security in most of the country, and development is at best going very slowly. So the kind of mandate that would be supported by the majority of nations, which is not now supported on security force for Afghanistan, could really be useful. The lack of security is really holding things up.
And you're saying that the United Nations, as you understand it, would be the best organization to do that. Is that based on the respect that they would get in Afghanistan or their ability to actually do the job?
Well, it isn't that only the United Nations could do it. It is that no one else is doing it. And were the mandate given to the United Nations with adequate support, it could clearly do the job.
But where's the roadblock?
The roadblock at present is both the lack of support in U.S. policy and the lack of resources by the United States and the other members of the international community who are providing support for Afghanistan.
So you're saying the U.S. is sort of a principal part of the blockage here, right?
So the U.S. assumed responsibility that it hasn't delivered on and has neither the forces nor the money behind it to do the job, nor does anyone else who has stepped up to the plate in terms of Afghanistan from the rest of the international community.
Okay, Raoul, thanks for your call. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. Ambassador Oakley, first to you on that, whether or not what we're talking about in terms of the responsibility of the United States is particular to this administration or a symptom of a larger, longer discomfort that this country has with what the UN can do.
Well, it goes back and forth. There was discomfort for a while during the Reagan administration. Then the United Nations was able to do some things that were very, very helpful. There was discomfort during the Nixon period. And again, the United Nations stepped up after the 1973 war in the Middle East to do some things that were very helpful. This administration has found the UN to be helpful in some places. For example, I said in East Timor, which is the previous administration, mm-hmm. but this administration also has found the UN to be helpful in some areas, like in Africa. So we'll see. But in general, in Afghanistan, makes the point. The United Nations would hardly be a powerful enough force to deal with the sort of problem that's going on there. I agree that the United States is primarily responsible for leading the coalition and providing the security, and more security needs to be provided. I think there was a misjudgment of the amount of security that would be needed and along the duration which would be required. The same thing has happened in Iraq. Corrections are being made in Iraq. I suspect there will be some corrections made in Afghanistan, but it will be a partnership between the United States, other coalition members on the one hand, and the United Nations on the other.
And Jane Hall, when we talk about reluctance or unwillingness to support it, do you see that as something that comes from the administration or from the people in the country that the administration represents?
Well, I mean, I think we can't underestimate the difficulty of these problems. I mean, the United States is a member of the Security Council, and the entire Council has been given, under the provisions of the Charter, the primary responsibility by the member states for the maintenance of peace and security around the world. This is a huge responsibility. How do you differentiate? How do you set priorities? How do you take on the actual operational implications of what this responsibility means? In the case of Afghanistan, just an example where there is a great need for security, some people have argued that this is a clear example of the value of the Brahimi finding. Don't take on, be more careful about the missions you take on, as Ambassador Oakley said. Set realistic objectives, but importantly, very importantly, resource the mandates. That's the challenge that lies ahead.
All right. Ambassador Oakley, thanks for being with us on the program today.
You're very welcome.
Bob Oakley served in the State Department for 34 years. He was special envoy to Somalia from 92 to 1994. And Connection listeners, we continue our conversation about the future of UN peacekeeping. We'd like to have you in. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. I'm Dick Gordon. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. In this hour, we're talking about UN peacekeepers. Some of them have been in places where they were assigned to keep the peace for a long time. Some in the Middle East now for nigh on 55 years. India and Pakistan, 54 years. UN peacekeepers in Cyprus for 40, in Lebanon for 25 years. There are some 15 different missions around the world right now, an annual budget of something like $2.5 billion. And some questions have been raised recently about whether or not the UN ought to be taking a more active peacekeeping role in the Middle East. The Secretary General, Kofi Annan, said in an interview with the key Israeli newspaper earlier this week that perhaps this was the time to think about bringing in armed peacekeepers to keep the two sides apart if neither the Palestinians nor the Israelis are able to do what each one of them has to do to move down the roadmap towards peace. Talking about that and the future of peacekeeping with us on the program today, Jane Hall-Lute. She's newly appointed to her job as Assistant Secretary General for Mission Support in the Department of Peacekeeping, takes up those duties on the 1st of August. We're going to take our first call, our next call, rather, from Raleigh, North Carolina. Bob's on the line. Hi, Bob.
Hi there.
Thanks for calling.
Right. Excuse me. I wonder if your guest thinks there might be a practical possibility for a permanent UN force that could respond quickly to the will of the Security Council or the General Assembly.
Sort of a rapid reaction force?
Yes. And under, you know, under the command of UN officers.
Jane?
I think it's a really interesting idea. Several years ago, I was associated with the Carnegie Commission on Preventing Deadly Conflict, which looked at ways in which the international community could prevent the outbreak of violence, keep peace while there was still a peace to keep, as a matter of fact. And we looked at this question and found that there was really a compelling military argument for just such a capacity. These are very complex operations. You can expect unalloyed success when you have to pull them together ad hoc and in haste. And so there's a real argument for this. There are provisions in the Charter, for example, for member states to provide standby arrangements for the UN to be called upon in such a circumstance. And I think the experience of the 90s shows that there is still value and merit in the basic idea, and in fact that a real practical application might be the formulation of a rapidly deployable policing capacity that could be put in place while there was still a peace to keep. And so this is an idea that I think does have merit, but again, it will be up to the member states to make it happen.
Would that be the sort of team, Jane, that might have, for example, if it were in place, have been used in Baghdad at a time when, in the moments after the fighting there, it was clear that that kind of police support was required, was needed?
Oh, that's quite a different circumstance. I mean, this was a war. This was a military engagement that I think reminded us of a couple of realities about war. And the first one is that war is a ground reality. You have to be on the ground to consolidate the control that you have. One of the things that is interesting about this Gulf War as against the last one, the last time we had decisive victory without decisive defeat. This time we have decisive defeat and some say without decisive victory, and it really is the post-war period that will determine how things are shaped. Clearly the UN has a role to play, and that role has been recognized and is now unfolding.
So if there was a UN ready to roll police team, into what sort of conflict would you send that group? I'm just trying to understand how they would work.
Right. I think if it were very clear, and it often is, I mean, I don't want to be overly deterministic, but the problem with violent conflict today on the scale that we're seeing it, and Iraq again is quite a different case, but on the scale that we're seeing it, this kind of violence, for example, as we saw in Somalia in the early 1990s, mm-hmm. This is known. The problem is not that we don't know. It's that we don't often act. And we don't often act in part because we don't like the actions that we feel forced to take. We don't have the capacity. We don't have the models. We don't have the operational understanding of what it will take. And frankly, the interests of insiders and outsiders differ in many of these conflicts. So these are very complex at every dimension.
All right, Bob, thanks very much for your call. Next to Franklin, Virginia, Calvin's on the line. Hi, Calvin.
Hello, how are you doing?
Fine, thanks for calling.
Yeah, I just wanted to say, to me, it seems that the UN agenda is pretty much led by the haves and the have-nots. I mean, you just look at the situation in the Middle East, where it just seems like a land-grabbing thing going on, when in fact the U.S., if it had a real compassion as far as resolving the issue in the Middle East, they would allow the U.S. to go in and divide the two. But it's clearly obvious that it's not going to happen because there's so much interest as far as the people that have everything trying to create like an infinite worker class, and that being the Palestinians, more or less.
So what are you saying is the problem here, Calvin, with the United Nations, that the UN is being run by who?
It's being ran by those that have everything, that controls everything, like the U.S. I mean, if you look at the way the U.S. has been operated within the past, it's like if there's a nation that has something of value in that country, the UN would go in and try to do something about it. But if that country really has no value, nothing gets done.
You know what? I'm not sure that I agree with you. When I was posted overseas for a number of years and traveling into a number of very small countries, which, you know, on the global stage would be considered pretty insignificant players, all those countries put a huge value on the United Nations as a place where they did have at least some kind of equal status to be heard.
I flew into quite a few countries. I used to be in the Air Force.
Yeah.
And, I mean, we flew in the Guadalcanal, and the only reason we flew in there is because the Russians wanted a warm water port. So we go in and try to provide relief once they had a natural disaster that happened. Any other time, we never would have went in there. I mean, the same thing applies to Malaysia, mm-hmm. the Philippines. I mean, I spent like 4 years in the Philippines. And if you look at all the conflict that was going on over there and all the things that was doctrined by the U.S., I mean, it was all being handled by those that had the stuff and those that didn't. I mean, if you look at the New People's Army in the Philippines and all the things going on, it's pretty much the peasants that didn't have anything that was fighting against those that had.
Okay, Calvin, we lost the line, but your point's a good one, and I do want to hear Jane speak about this idea that the big countries, the permanent members of the Security Council, are ultimately the ones who decide just what the UN ought to be focused on, that, you know, perhaps the concerns of the smaller countries, though well-expressed, don't get the attention they should. Is that a reasonable criticism, Jane?
Well, it's an observation that certainly many people have made and has some basis in fact, not in part because of what I said earlier, where the members of the Security Council have been given by the member states the primary responsibility for maintaining peace and security. So this is not something they simply arrogate to themselves. By the charter's provisions, they have that responsibility. On the other hand, critics also say, particularly critics in the United States, that the UN is captured by developing world states, by smaller states relative to the United States and its allies, with interests that are quite counter to what the dominant states wants. And so the U.S. is frustrated and thwarted in its efforts to use the UN effectively. This brings me back to my point that I think the core consensus that gave the institution its fundamental underpinnings and vitality really needs to be reestablished.
Okay, I do want to get back to that. I'm going to try and squeak in one more call on the program, though. We're going to go to Marblehead now, Massachusetts. Robert's on the line. Hi, Robert.
Hi, how are you?
I'm fine. Thank you for calling.
Until 9/11, until the Second Intifada, and until the Iraq debate, I was raised from childhood as a great believer in the United Nations and that fantasy. And I've come to see, it seems to me, that first, the words international community are themselves an oxymoron. Secondly, the way that consistently Israel and the Israelis have been treated in the United Nations makes the idea that in any respect, aside from the tactical and strategic reasons of how to deal with terrorists, that the UN could play any kind of constructive role in that situation is, to me, incomprehensible.
Are you saying, Robert, that Israel is singled out, is persecuted at the UN, sort of high status at the UN?
Oh, if you want to take a look at the numbers of people that are hired and are working at the United Nations that are Israeli compared even to the numbers of Palestinians who don't have any state status within the UN, you could take a look at that, you know, or the idea of Iraq on the Human Rights Council and Iran and so on and so forth.
Okay, Robert, then yeah. Bring us to where we want to be at the end of the program, and that is what's wrong with it? If it's an organization of member states who get together and agree that they're going to try and make the world a better place, why isn't it working?
I think it's not working because I think fundamentally this notion of like member states and that states themselves all I can say is I don't know, except it's not. And I think part of the reason it's not is because we have this veiled delusion of words like international community that just doesn't exist, you know, and that we mistake the idea that somehow a force can come in and take action. And Africa, basically what we call states are mafia enterprises of warring clans, you know, who work then with other states in terms of the smuggling of weapons, the smuggling of drugs, the laundering of money, you know, the getting of resources. It's a right. Terrible, terrible situation. I don't know what to do.
Jane, here's someone who needs his faith restored.
Well, I have children, I suppose. That's why I have to be optimistic, and I am. And I actually committed to the value of the United Nations, not only sort of as a citizen of the world, but really as an American. This is an institution that we essentially helped found. It's our values. It's our norms. It's the things we hold really dear. It's our interests also at stake in the success of this organization, very clearly. Many Americans want the United States to remain dominant and prosperous. And many of the rest of the world want the world to acknowledge that and say, well, and we want a world better off for that. And the UN is our best hope to manage that. The UN has a number of successes. I mean, look at WHO and the management of the SARS crisis. Look at UNHCR and its handling of refugee crises. Look at the role of UNICEF. And on and on and on and on. Around the world, there are many countries. In the case of Iraq, the vast majority of the population was kept alive through a food program administered by the United Nations. The UN has enormous an enormous and distinguished record of successes, but it's not without its problems. And again, the problems stem not from the fact that Libya chaired the Human Rights Commission, but from the fact that the machinery no longer reflects the basic consensus around which states can agree about how they will deal with each other. It probably is not a good thing that lethality, weapons, arms, munitions have become so diffused, so easily available. I mean, M16 is cheaper than breakfast in some places around the world. This is something that we need to get a hold of. And the member states need to determine what kind of organization they want and then to need to take concrete steps to reestablish that kind of an organization. And it speaks to a fundamental truth, quite frankly, that force cannot do all that needs doing. And all that needs doing cannot be done alone. And for this, we have the United Nations. If we didn't have it, we would have to invent it and many of the functions that it performs on behalf of millions of people around the world.
All right, Robert, thanks very much for that call. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio, which sort of brings us back to where we began, Jane, with you in terms of finding this new core consensus. You are in charge of mission support in peacekeeping. That means when the boots hit the ground, you're in charge of the boots, making sure they're laced up. So you know how, and you've had a lot of experience in getting stuff down. How do you get to a new core consensus?
Right. I think this is something that the Security Council will have to recognize is its responsibility. The institution is the House, as it's called. The agencies that operate within the United Nations really function on behalf of the member states. But it is these states which came together 55 years ago and said, in again, that very, very particular setting of the world was in at the end of World War II, where it was not just the defeat of Nazism, but the repudiation of the old order, repudiation of a simple might makes right reality. And that states would come together and agree on some basic principles.
You have to somehow convince the Permanent Five to give up some power. That seems to be the real problem here.
I don't know that they have to give up any more power than they have agreed already. And in fact, some have said they've become more powerful by virtue of their status on the Council. But this is responsibility. With power go responsibilities, and that's certainly part of it here.
Well, lots of luck in your new job.
Appreciate it very much.
Jane Hall-Loop, who, as of the 1st of August, will be the UN's Assistant Secretary General for Mission Support in the Peacekeeping Department. We also talked earlier in the program with the former U.S. Ambassador, Robert Oakley. Now, Connection listeners, if you've got ideas and notions about this that you want to share with others, click into the forum section of our website. We're at theconnection.org. We had help with our program today from Kim Bichari, Darren Manoogian, Brian Myers, and Carl Volker. Our program is produced by Sean Carberry, Sarah Field, Elaine Grant, Gail Harris, Kelly Jones, Arit Karitsky-Fox, Jen Mattson, Lindsay Miller, Christina Russo, and Doug Sugarts. Our interns are Kate Sarnowski, Andrea Liebman, and Lisa Ruffino. Our senior producers, Tara Murphy. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.